Hi, welcome to the Behind the Balance Sheet podcast, where we meet leading investors and commentators and educate ourselves about the world of investing and the world. Our mission is to remove some of the mystique around investing and improve our understanding of what makes a successful investment, or indeed an unsuccessful one. Our goal is to inform, educate, and entertain. We hope you enjoy this and every episode.
Behind the Balance Sheet and affiliates and podcast guests may own shares or have an economic interest in securities discussed in this podcast, which is aired for your education and entertainment only. Nothing in this podcast should be construed as investment advice or relied upon for investment decisions. Always do your own research.
Are traditional expert calls in the investment world becoming obsolete? According to Stream, they are, and you can access primary research easily and efficiently through their platform. With Stream, you have the right insights at your fingertips to make the best investment decisions. They offer a vast library of over 26,000 expert transcripts powered by AI search technology. Plus, they provide competitive rates on expert call services, and you can even have an experienced buy-side analyst conduct the calls for you. But that's not all. Stream also provides the ability to engage with experts one-on-one and get your calls transcribed free of charge, all for 40% less than you would pay for 20 calls in a traditional expert network model. So if you're looking to optimize your research process and increase ROI in investment research spend, Stream has the solution for you. This podcast is intended to educate and entertain, but we also have a more serious purpose. We support the Financial Times Financial Literacy Charity. Check it out on ft.com/flick. It's the most disadvantaged in society who get taken in by financial scams, by payday loans, and similar artful devices designed to part people from their money. We can change this. It's a straightforward task of education. This is a great cause, and I urge you, please, to support it. William Green isn't an investor, yet he is investing royalty. Charlie Munger, Warren Buffett's right-hand man, reads 300 books a year and is one of the sharpest brains in the investing world, and probably the world. He thinks Green's book, Richer, Wiser, Happier, is one of the best investing books ever written. That should make Green happier and richer, but he's still looking over his shoulder at Morgan Housel, whose first book has had even higher sales. This surprised me because Green's a man in search of contentment. Perhaps interviewing 40 of the world's best investors has given him a competitive streak. His book has been crafted with great precision and enormous care. He talks in the second half of this interview about crafting a chapter so that it contained exactly 11,111 words, because it gave him pleasure. Richer, Wiser, Happier was a five-year labor of love, and it shines through. Green talks about the more you study great investors, the more interesting characters you find, and his is an exploration of more than investing, it's an exploration of life. Green started out with an interest in investing as a smart aleck shortcut way of making a living without doing too much work. His words. He's come round to a life philosophy which asks, is there any downside to having integrity? For him, this has become a moral and intellectual pursuit. Green reflects on the characteristics of great investors. To be really good, you have to be maniacal, to have a lack of emotion and a degree of obsessiveness. And all that doesn't make for the best spouses, hence the high divorce rate. A lot of professional investors listen to this podcast, perhaps hoping to improve their skills. This episode may not improve your investing skills, but it might just improve your life. I'm sure you'll enjoy it. I had a blast. William, I'm so excited to be with you today, and thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
It's such a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And I normally ask people, you know, how they got into the investment business. And I mean, I guess you didn't set out with the idea that you would write a book that sold, goodness knows how many copies. I mean, what did you want to do when you were a kid?
Oh, I wanted to be a writer from very early on. I remember I had this wonderful great uncle, a guy called Dick Peer, who was a professor at the University of Nottingham. And I remember sitting with him when I was about 7, 8, 9 years old. Seven or eight at my grandmother's apartment in London. And Dick said in this very affable, cordial way, what do you want to be when you grow up, William? And I think I surprised myself by saying a writer. And he said to me, you know, all of my friends who are writers say that the most important thing is just to write a lot so that you get your voice. And it was, A, an incredibly helpful piece of advice, and B, it was so modest and lovely and uncondescending, given the fact that he was a very renowned politics professor, and as I discovered decades later, had written plenty of books himself. And it was a sort of consummate way to treat a young person with respect, a total lack of condescension, kindness. He was a really lovely man. And so I always wanted to be a writer, and I wasn't really very good at many other things. I mean, I loved language. I loved literature. I studied English literature at Oxford. I was okay at languages, but I can count to about 7. And so I'm entirely unqualified to be an expert on investing. So in some ways, it's some kind of cosmic joke. But what happened, I guess, in my 20s is that I just became obsessed with the market. I just sort of fell in love with the stock market. And I think it was slightly just because I'm sort of lazy and subversive. And I just thought, this is the most amazing thing. If you can play this game intelligently, you don't have to work that hard. And so I had this kind of this slightly naive dream that by being smart about investing, I would be able to do these other things like write without having to take orders from annoying bosses or things like that. And so I think that was the start of my obsession with the market. And then I just found it really fascinating. And so part of what happened is that I was able to interview these great investors because I was a journalist. So I was writing for magazines like Forbes and Money and Fortune and later for Time and Barron's and things like this. So I was in this very unusual position in that I could actually go and interview famous investors and sort of indulge this weird obsession that I had, which is an odd obsession for a very literary person. Like, you know, if you came from my sort of background, you regarded people who were interested in money and business as slightly tawdry and vulgar and crass, and we were much more high-minded. But I just thought it was an amazing game. And the more I started to study these people, the more I just thought, these are amazing characters. I mean, I'm sure you found the same, Steve, right? Like at the upper echelon of the investing world, there are some pretty weird, interesting, brilliant, eccentric characters. And they're smart about so many things, not just investing, but about how to think.
Well, there's a few psychopaths, and they all have a streak of brilliance, no question. And it's interesting because it's not outlawed, Eton, because you're meant to be a prime minister or something. But there are, you're my third old Etonian actually on the podcast, which is quite funny, particularly given my background. But where did you start? What was your first journalist job?
Well, gosh, let me think back. I'm 54 now, so this is a long time ago. So I left Oxford pretty young. I was 20, and partly just because my birthday is in August, and I hadn't taken a gap year. And so I left, and I was obsessed with these authors like Ford Madox Ford and Joseph Conrad. And Ford and Conrad had this very interesting relationship together where they'd written books together. And at one point, Conrad got incredibly depressed, and Ford was so brilliant that he could actually write the next installment of Conrad's novel in Conrad's voice without anyone knowing. And so I saw that there was a biography of this slightly underrated great novelist, Ford Madox Ford. There was this biography coming out, and I thought, well, that'd be cool. I'll write an article about Ford's relationship with Conrad, and I'll send it to various publications. And so I went to the Hay-on-Wye Literary Festival with my late father, who was a barrister and a judge. And while I was there, I mailed out this article that I'd written about Ford's relationship with Conrad. And my father at the time said he thought, oh, poor William, he's going to be so disappointed. And I sent it to 5 publications, which you're not supposed to do. And I had no idea. And there was a thing in a book called The Writer's Digest that said that The Spectator, which is this great old magazine, I mean, more conservative than I am, but a great old magazine that all of these famous writers had written for. And it said that they accepted unsolicited manuscripts, which was a mistake. It's not true. It wasn't true then anyway. And they were one of the 5 publications I sent this article to. And they sent back this buff-colored envelope with a copy of the magazine in it, with my article in it, printed, with maybe 1 word changed, 2 words changed, where I had put the mot juste and then a translated as the correct word or something. They'd taken out that translation. That was the only change. And I had a check for £70. And I just remember standing in my, in the doorway of my apartment in Clapham in those days. Now I live in New York. And just doing this kind of victory dance, just, you know, that one of those half dozen moments in your life of just total and utter elation. And I just thought, this is the most amazing thing. I mean, this is the publication that people like Graham Greene wrote for and Dr. Johnson. And it was just such an ecstatic thing. And so that really was the start. And then I started writing for The Spectator and the Literary Review. And then I moved to New York and I wrote for The New Yorker for the Talk of the Town section at a time when you didn't even have a byline. So I used to say that I was anonymously famous. And so it was kind of this magical thing. And in those days, because we didn't have the internet, nobody knew how inexperienced I was. So I would get sent off, for example, to Mississippi to write a story about this white supremacist called Byron DeLay Beckwith, who had killed a great black civil rights leader in the 60s and was being retried after being acquitted in the 60s by an all-white jury. And I got this assignment from the Independent magazine, which was then probably the best magazine in the country, to go write a 4,000-word, eight-page story about this in Mississippi, in Jackson, Mississippi. I must have been about 23. And I think the reason was partly what I realized later is there was another William Green who wrote for publications like Vogue and was a very good writer. And I think they probably assumed it was him.
Oh, that's lovely. Yeah,
yeah, it's kind of like if you read Evelyn Waugh's novel, Scoop, you know, they send the wrong guy to cover the war. And so I was that. And so it was a kind of magical thing. And you could ask people anything. And you can imagine the wonder of going to a place like Jackson, Mississippi, and writing about a white supremacist. And literally, you know, I'm like a Jewish kid from London, but I have a posh accent and went to Eton and Oxford. And so they thought I was some kind of WASP. And so I would have, you know, the wife of this white supremacist literally asking me if I wanted to take her visitation rights to go visit her white supremacist husband in prison. And then in the end, they canceled my visit because he decided that he wasn't going to eat because he was convinced that the Jews were poisoning him or something like that. And so, but you can imagine for a young, curious guy in his early 20s to go around the world and do stories like that, it was just magnificent.
That is amazing. And who was the first investor you interviewed? Do you remember?
I think the first investor I interviewed was Marty Whitman, who I was obsessed with because he was this great curmudgeonly old value investor. And I was a value investor from pretty much instantly. Value investing just made sense to me. And I'm sort of an outsider and a contrarian by nature and a bit of a smart aleck and subversive. And I guess I have this sort of snobbish view that the crowd is somehow stupid. And wouldn't it be wonderful if we could outwit the crowd by being smarter? And so it sort of appealed to me. And Whitman in those days was 80 something and he had a fantastic record. And he was curmudgeonly and rude about, you know, how little his competition understood and how rational his approach was. But he had a great record. And I invested in his fund and later had a separate account with him. And what was interesting was he really was great. And he was very tough and very remarkable, a terrific investor. But then during the financial crisis, he totally screwed up. And he was left holding all of these stocks like MBIA, which were totally catastrophic. And I interviewed him after it and I said, why did you do so badly during the financial crisis? Like not only did you own so many of these duds, but then you totally failed to buy when everything was crushed. And he said this remarkable thing to me. He said, as I got older and richer, I became lazy. And I thought that was an extraordinary admission. And he said, but look, what's the difference? You know, I mean, if my kids and charity inherit tens of millions of dollars left, $10, $20 million left, it's not the end of the world. And I didn't have the heart to say to him, you know, I got my mother to set up a separate account with you and you really served her poorly. You failed in your fiduciary responsibility to my elderly mother. And it's a really important thing, I think, to recognize that this is a kind of moral undertaking. There were people who suffered because he didn't do his job. And if he took his eye off the ball because he was getting tired or rich or lazy, that was a sort of moral failing. And I didn't have the heart to say it to him.
Why not?
You know, I'm sort of, I don't know. I tend to try as I get older to be a little bit kinder. And so if you notice, like in my book, for the most part, the person who comes in for most criticism is me. I'm pretty happy to sort of mock myself for my own stupidity and failings and mistakes. I try not to point the finger that much at people. But I did mention in the book that I thought he failed on that front. And the reason I mentioned it wasn't so much to sort of take a dig at him. What I was trying to do was to remind people who were reading the book, who manage money, that you do, in a sense, have a sacred responsibility. And it's very easy to get caught up in the idea of like, well, look at my Ferrari and my Lamborghini and look at my big house and look how beautiful my suit is from Savile Row and stuff. And to forget that, you know, these are people's retirement savings and their kids' college. And my mother's retirement would be better if Whitman had done his job more rigorously. And so for that rare occasion where I actually did point out somebody's flaw and failing, there was a reason for it. There is a sort of slightly ill-concealed proselytizing gene that I have, where there is a sort of slightly moralistic side to me, where I'm not trying to wag the finger at anyone, but I want people to look at some of the people in the book who are great role models and say, oh yeah, that's a pretty cool way to do capitalism. And one of the people I really admire, there's a guy, Tom Gaynor, that I write about at some length in the book. And Tom Gaynor, who runs the Markel Corporation, which is a sort of mini Berkshire that's become, you know, one of the Forbes Fortune 400 companies, a big company. He was a devout Quaker as a kid and ended up becoming, you know, quite a devout Presbyterian now as an adult, and is very moral about running money. And he at one point, he had been talking to Chris Davis, who comes from this kind of famous family of three generations of great money managers. And Chris, who's now on the board of Berkshire Hathaway, said to me, you know, you really need to focus heavily on Tom Gaynor, because he's really the reason why I became a money manager. And I said, how come? And he said, well, I was thinking of going into seminary, even though I think he was agnostic at the time, but he was thinking of becoming a seminarian. And he said, I you know, his father and his grandfather were both legendary investors. And he said to Tom Gaynor, I feel like this is a low calling, being a money manager. You know, it's like, is it really valuable? And Gaynor said to him, look, this is one of the oldest professions, you know, maybe the second oldest profession in the Bible, right? It's, you know, you're a custodian of people's wealth. And that's a holy duty. And that had a huge impact on Chris. And it actually enabled him to stay in the investment business, that sense of like, yeah, no, I'm doing something that's really valuable. And just protecting people, A, from themselves, from doing stupid stuff themselves, and protecting them from other unscrupulous people who are going to screw them and take advantage of them, I think Charlie Munger, Buffett's partner, says it's a low vocation, but it is a vocation. And I don't know. I think there's what better than to enable someone to send their kids to college and retire comfortably without fear, things like that. That seems pretty valuable to me.
No, I think it is a profession, although it seems bizarre that anybody can do it. You don't need to have any qualifications, and there's not really a professional qualification other than the CFA, which is, you know, I don't consider it to be a qualification.
But you had to get pretty serious about things like forensic accounting and stuff, right? I mean, there were skills that you needed to get good at this, weren't there?
I started from that perspective. But I mean, I know investors who never opened accounts, you know, and are perfectly successful. I mean, you don't, there are so many ways to be successful at this game, that there isn't a standard way, which is what I think is one of the aspects that make it so interesting. So, you know, from my perspective, I'm interested in the way different people approach it. And, you know, your bent is really about the characters, isn't it?
Yeah.
If you enjoy this podcast, you're bound to enjoy our free newsletter on Substack. It's a weekly email on interesting investing topics. Visit behindthebalancesheet.com and hit the sign up button. While you're there, you might want to check out our brilliant online investor training school. Hundreds of students have taken our flagship Analyst Academy course, which teaches you everything you need to become a serious equity investor. And if you're a professional investor, we run a forensic accounting course for institutional clients, and soon a cohort-based course for serious amateurs. Email us at info@behindthebalancesheet.com.
So you managed to interview Marty Whitman, and was that like they said, oh, William, you're really good at this, go and interview the next guy? Or were you interviewing people from a wide range of backgrounds?
I just kept pitching stuff. You know, I was working at Forbes at the time, so I wrote a story called The Master and His Apprentice, which was about the fact that this old curmudgeonly guy, Marty Whitman, had to find a successor. And I was saying, well, so how do you find a successor? How do you find someone who's any good? And so I talked about Sir John Templeton, you know, trying to figure out how to find a successor, stuff like that. And then I would do things where I would think, all right, well, what would be a fun thing to do? And I was thinking, well, so Sir John Templeton's a pretty old, kooky, interesting guy. It'd be kind of fun to go visit him in the Bahamas. And so I would write to him and he would say, yeah, I'm happy to give you an interview. And I'd go spend the day with him in the Bahamas. So then I would write a story on the secrets of Sir John Templeton. Or I had this idea around then, I started to get really interested in this idea of the master's masters. I sort of thought, when you look at the greatest investors, who influenced them? So then I would do things like I would interview Marty Whitman about his mentor, the guy who influenced him most. And I went to interview that guy who was even older than Marty. He was 90-something. And he was a guy called Helmut Friedlander. And Marty said to me, he said, I hated him, but he was an amazing mentor. And so I go interview this old guy, Helmut Friedlander, and he's wearing two watches. One is a Patek Philippe and the other is a very cheap Timex. And the Patek Philippe watch had been given to him by the family that ran the Sears Roebuck business that had originally set that up, and he managed their money. And we talked about all these things that he had done over the years. Like he'd bought the Empire State Building at one point for, you know, and he traded coffee futures. And he was just this brilliant old curmudgeon. And he said to me at one point, he said, I always used to have male secretaries. And one of them, I have a stomach pain. I think I have an ulcer. And he said to me, Mr. Friedlander, you don't have an ulcer. You give ulcers. And so he was just this tough old guy. And he refused to shake my hand because of the germs, which in those days was very unusual. This is 20-something years ago. And he had this amazing bottle, I think, of century-old port on his desk. Or sherry, it was, actually. And I said to him, will you drink that? And he said, of course I will drink that. And he started telling me about these two cases of Chateau Petrus that he had drunk recently, that he'd bought in auction. And he said to me, I have lived uproariously. And I just thought, what an amazing thing. So I was going off and interviewing these strange, interesting characters. And so for that same story, which never got published, I went to interview Michael Price about his mentor, Max Heine. I went to interview Peter Lynch, the legendary Fidelity investor, about his mentor, Ned Johnson, who was the founder of Fidelity, which now manages, what, $9, $10 trillion. I interviewed Jack Bogle, who founded the Vanguard Group, which manages $7 trillion, something like that. And there was a moment when I was interviewing Jack Bogle where the phone went dead as we were talking about his mentor, this guy, Walter Morgan, who was one of the great early mutual fund managers in the US. And I listened to my recording later and I was saying, Mr. Bogle, are you there? Have I lost you? And he said, sorry, it brought tears to my eyes. And I sort of had to gather myself. And, you know, as a journalist, you're having always, as you're interviewing, to sort of adjust on your feet to what they're saying. And I was like, well, how come? And he said, well, I realized how much I loved him and how much he did for me. And so for me, this was just kind of riveting. Like I would get to write about what he had learned from Walter Morgan about integrity, for example, and then share it with readers. So for example, there was a moment, I think I write this in the notes on sources and additional resources in my book that I tell this story, where I was asking Bogle about this mentor of his, Walter Morgan. And he said, well, one of the things I learned from him is he cared so much about his clients. And I said, can you give me an example? And he said, well, one person wrote him a letter. I mean, I'm guessing this is in the 40s or 50s, something in the 50s probably, and said, Mr. Morgan, I need a suit. Do you have a suit for me? And he said, by God, Mr. Morgan sent him one of his suits. And so in telling that story in my book, part of what I'm doing is honoring the memory of Walter Morgan. And part of what I'm doing is honoring the memory of Jack Bogle, who's also dead. And part of what I'm doing is in a kind of subtly proselytizing way. I'm saying, do you see what this mindset was that informed the way they behaved? And that mindset is deeply imbued in Vanguard, which has driven down expenses unbelievably. Instead of gouging its shareholders, they're giving you a good deal. And so there's something. So for me, the whole thing of covering investing, it went from being a smart alecky way to make money without doing much work, just by sort of sitting there with my feet on my desk, reading and thinking, to looking at these broader questions, like, how are you supposed to live? Well, should you have integrity? Is there a downside to having integrity? If you have integrity, are people going to take advantage of you and you're just like a mug? Is it just a Darwinian dog-eat-dog world? Or should you behave better? And so I would have these conversations with someone like Tom Gaynor, who I mentioned before, the guy from Markel. And he said to me at one point, look, I would behave this way even if there were no benefit to it. It's just a better way to behave, and it makes me happier. And so for me, it became a kind of moral pursuit. And I think part of, you know, moral and intellectual, because the greatest investors are extraordinary thinkers. And so they're great pragmatists, right? They don't get caught up in dogma, because dogma is very expensive. Because if you become dogmatic, you blind yourself and you can't see properly or think properly. And so I started to realize these were the most free-thinking, open-minded people. I was looking over an interview yesterday that I'd done with Howard Marks a few months ago on my podcast. And Howard was talking about spending time during COVID, shacked up at home with his son, Andrew, who helps to manage the family's money. And he was talking about how Andrew was saying to him, look, you know nothing about Bitcoin. Why on earth are you so against Bitcoin? Why are you reflexively, reactively skeptical about Bitcoin when you know nothing about it? You know nothing about the technology. You know nothing about the supply-demand dynamic. This isn't an area of expertise for you. And Howard said to me, well, yeah, I'd made lots of money over the years. I've become a multi-billionaire by being skeptical of the new thing and of hype and all of that. And I had to admit, yeah, that's a bias, and I need to examine that. And I don't know what I'm talking about, and I shouldn't just leap to conclusions. And I think in many ways his skepticism was justified. But the fact that he was so determined to be open-minded and so determined to learn from his son and to say, what do I know? Am I really qualified to know this? That's an incredible attitude, an incredible mindset. And so I started to think that the greatest investors were like these practical philosophers. They were looking at what works in life. And this is something Munger specifically says. Munger once said, I observe what works and doesn't work and why. And when you contrast that with politicians or professors, you know, or journalists, it's not just that we're blinded by our biases, it's that we don't have that much at stake. And so when we screw up and we get something wrong, we pay a price and it's kind of embarrassing. But if you have hundreds of millions of dollars on the line when you bet on something and you're wrong and you're misguided, you really pay a price. And likewise, if you're right and you think better than everyone else, you get such an incredible reward. So I think it reminds me of Dr. Johnson, you remember, who wrote the dictionary, who said something like the prospect of hanging concentrates the mind admirably. And I think that the prospect of losing hundreds of millions of dollars concentrates the mind admirably. It forces you to think well, think clearly.
Well, of course, you've got tremendous feedback. And one of the better ways of improving performance is to have feedback on what you're doing. The other thing that I think is quite interesting is that the best investors, they're curious. So Howard Marks was curious about Bitcoin, probably. And I think curiosity is something which unites investors and journalists. I think to be a good journalist, you have to be very curious. And you obviously are.
Yeah, relentlessly. And I think one of the things is you can't fake interest. And so when you look at the greatest investors, they're playing this game that they can't get enough of. You know, they can't stop. I was interviewing a guy, John Spears, who has a great record over 50 years at this great old firm, Tweedy Brown. So it's actually the firm that Buffett bought his stake in Berkshire Hathaway through. And Ben Graham used to make his trades through Tweedy Brown back in the 30s and 40s. And so it's this great old investment firm in New York. And John Spears was saying to me, he's maybe 74 now. He said, I just love reading the paper every day through this economic lens, trying to figure out, oh, here's what this means about Meta. Here's what this means about these Chinese stocks that I own. And that sense of just loving the game, constantly wanting to keep learning, I think that's a key thing. And so I think if there's any takeaway from that, it's that you want to really look at your own life and say, am I playing some game that I'm really suited to play, that obsesses me for its own sake? And you do, Munger talks about this a lot. He says, look, if you're 5'4", don't become a basketball player because, you know, you're not really suited to it. But you also have to, you have to play games, A, that you're suited to, and B, that you're passionate about. And that's been a very helpful filter for me, because one of the things that happens when you write a book, if it does well, is you get all of these other opportunities, right? To do speeches or to do a podcast or to, you know, people will say you should set up a Substack newsletter. And you have to look at yourself and really say, A, what am I good at? And B, what do I really care about? Like, what would I actually do for pleasure? And when I look at the greatest investors, I think the money that they make is very pleasing, and it's a good scorecard, and it gives them independence and latitude to live the way they want. But I think the game itself has to be utterly intoxicating. Does that make any sense? Is that
absolutely? I mean, I think it's the game that, you know, because once you've got 100 million or 200 million, I don't know how much you need. It is just a scorecard. And, you know, I've been fortunate, like you, to meet some of these guys that have made, you know, huge amounts of money. And the money isn't the thing that motivates them. You know, Sir Chris Hone, yeah. He wears a Timex or a Swatch. And, you know, you think, and, you know, why'd you wear a Swatch, Chris? And he says, well, you know, it tells the time. It's quite good. Looks quite attractive. In my, you know, and there's just no need for anything better. Has anybody ever refused an interview? Are you now so, I mean, maybe now post the book they want, but I mean, have you had experience where people said, because John Templeton, I mean, why did he bother being interviewed by you? He was old, successful. He didn't need an article in Forbes.
Yeah, with Templeton, I was kind of cunning back then. There's a lot of charm and cajolery and strategizing involved in getting interviews. And in those days, I was much, I was probably more devious and hungry and unscrupulous. And I had seen that he'd become obsessed with this spiritual investigation that really captivated him, particularly in, I guess, in his 80s. He was about 86, 87 when I interviewed him. And he wanted to increase what he called the spiritual wealth of humanity 100-fold. And so he was on this mission to investigate things like the power of prayer. And he would do things like he would fund research at Harvard Medical School into whether prayer worked and what type of prayer worked. And, you know, very interesting stuff that at the time I regarded as totally kooky, because in those days I was sort of somewhere between agnostic and atheistic. The joke is sort of on me because I've become increasingly spiritual, and the stuff that he was trying to teach me back then, that I was totally closed-minded about, now I would be much more open-minded about. So I think I kind of slightly conned him into thinking we were just going to talk about this whole spiritual thing, which we did talk about. But I really wanted to figure out, how do we get rich? You know, what can we learn from him about how to be a great investor? Because He had this incredible record. I think he had averaged 14.5% for something like 38 years.
It's astonishing, isn't it? I mean,
yeah. And then he had, and he was really the, you know, the first great global investor, the first guy picking international stocks. And so I was fascinated by, so there was a sort of sleight of hand there where I was cajoling him into talking to me about one thing. And then I ended up talking to him about a lot of other things. And I think at a certain point during the day, he got kind of irritated at me because I think he realized that I was pretty closed-minded. And so in the chapter that I write about him in my book, part of what I'm doing is I'm literally saying, this is what I was too stupid to understand 20-something years ago. And there's a thing, again, in the notes on sources and resources where I talk about how I was reading a book of his a few years ago, and I literally groaned out loud, and I flushed. I went totally and utterly red. And I was like, oh, God, that's what he was trying to teach me. And I realized just how obtuse and closed-minded I had been. And that was a very important lesson. It wasn't necessarily that he was right in his views. It was that he was open. He was curious. He was constantly investigating. And I was too arrogant and too closed-minded to see it. And so I sort of feel like I've been in this 20-something year argument with Templeton where I wanted to go back and look at what I'd missed. And one of the things that was very moving about going back and doing that was the realization that he was obsessed with gaining control over his mind and his thoughts and his emotions. And I realized, well, of course, look at what he went through. He started investing during World War II when the world seemed like it was just going off a precipice. And B, he had something like 3 young children and was on vacation with his first wife, and she died in a motorcycle accident. And so he suddenly had to take care of his family as a young widow with 3 kids. And so I think that obsession with gaining control over his emotions and his thoughts probably saved him to some degree. Whereas I looked at him in those days and I thought, there's something so ascetic and joyless and curmudgeonly and judgmental about him. I mean, I keep thinking of this, that he, when we were talking about retired people and whether he would ever retire, he said something like, the world is full of useless people. You know, these useless people who had retired and were doing nothing with themselves. And he had kind of contempt for it. And he said he was living in Lyford Quay next to all these people like Sean Connery and the Aga Khan and Grace Kelly, I think, had a house there. I mean, it was a beautiful place to live, right? And I said, do you go boating and things like that? And he said, no, I don't have time for things like that, you know? And I looked at this and I thought, what a joyless, curmudgeonly, judgmental guy this is. But joyless, not so much, because actually he told me he was the most joyful he'd ever been. But I think there was something about how stern he was with himself that made me uncomfortable.
But don't you think that these brilliant investors, they're sort of got a ruthless focus on the one thing. So they don't really know how to have fun, many of them. You know, it's so all-consuming. And it's, I mean, you know, being in markets, every day is challenging. You can't have a day off unless the stock market's got a day off. So
yeah, Bill Miller said something very interesting to me once. So Bill, who had famously beat the market for 15 years running, is just an extraordinarily clever guy who I've probably interviewed for 18, 90 hours over the last 22 years. So I've got to know him pretty well. He, early in his career, he went for advice to Peter Lynch. And he said to Peter Lynch something along the lines of, can you ever slow down? And Lynch said, no, not really. He said, there are 2 gears in investing. He's like, either you're full speed ahead or you stop. And Bill said he was more or less right. He said, you know, Peter used to carpool every morning at something like 6:30 in the morning so he could sort of sit in the car and read analyst reports. And I don't think he took a vacation in the 13 or 14 years that he was managing Fidelity Magellan. So he had this blazing return, but then he quit and retired. And so this is one thing I think about, right, that you need to have this tremendous intensity and sense of competition, but you also have to decide, are you setting yourself up in a way that's sustainable? And I think there's a real dynamic tension here where you know, there's an interesting line. I was interviewing Annie Duke recently, who is a poker champion and now an expert on risk. And she was talking about the book, the one on resilience, Grit, by Angela Duckworth. And she had written a book herself called Quit, which was about giving up, which in a way is the opposite of grit, right? So Annie was talking about how actually sometimes you need to know when to fold a hand, when you've got a lousy hand, and to move on, whether it's your job, your relationship, or your investment. And she said to me, she had been talking to Stephen Tetlock, who was the guy who wrote the book on super forecasting. And he said, the opposite of a virtue is also a great virtue. And so quitting and grit are the opposite and yet both virtues. And so this is a long-winded way of saying, likewise, when you think about, yes, you ought to be super competitive and be hard-charging like a Peter Lynch, and yet you also have to set yourself up so you can be resilient and last and durable. And so maybe sprinting so fast that you have an incredible record over 13, 14 years, but then have to quit is not such a good thing. Whereas Marty Whitman said to me, look, the great secret about this job is you don't have to work that hard. Look at me, I'm a long-term investor. I don't sell my stocks a lot. And he was wearing shorts and a tennis shirt and strolling into his office, and he looked pretty calm. But he took that too far and then didn't really exercise his fiduciary responsibility to my mother and his other shareholders by working hard enough. So I think, like most things in life, it's nuanced and contradictory. And I think anytime you come across a great truth, the opposite is also likely to be true. And so, yes, you got to be fanatical and driven. And at the same time, I think you have to think about, how am I going to have enough balance so that I'm going to be sustainable? And so, for example, like my friend Guy Speer, who manages the Aquamarine Fund, who I helped him write his book, The Educational Value Investor, Guy has set up his life in a way where he is sustainable. He very rarely makes an investment. Some years he'll make no investment at all. So he sits on his portfolio. He's probably owned Berkshire since, I think, 1999, something like that, when it was incredibly cheap, and he made it about 20-something percent of his portfolio, because everyone said that Buffett was finished back then, 24 years ago. And so Guy is moving slowly. And so I've often said to Guy, look, my investment with the Aquamarine Fund, it's a 40-year investment. You know, it's already 20 years, 22 years, and I think it'll be another 20 or so years. And I trust Guy because he's not running around like crazy. And sometimes I have friends with him on Facebook or something, and I'll see that he's gone off to Antarctica and is reading War and Peace. And I'm like, what the hell? Like, manage my money, dude. And then I'm like, no, that's exactly the right thing. Like, he's building a sustainable life. And what Guy said to me at one point is, he said, look, if I'm not nurturing my relationship with my wife and my three kids, then I'm making myself vulnerable. Like, you know, if I'm just thinking about the position of my Bloomberg terminal and whether it's too accessible, and so I'm looking at it the whole time. You know, he was cloning Nick Sleep, and he was saying, I should put it in an uncomfortable position so I'm not constantly looking at my Bloomberg terminal and being yanked around and made to act in a short-term way. It's like, yeah, that's important, but it's nowhere near as important as whether my relationship with my wife is good. And so I think when you're thinking about your life and how to build a sustainably successful life, you actually have to think about things, not just your work ethic and your productivity. You have to think about your relationships, because you have to say to yourself, when I'm in the crapper and I have terrible returns and I made a terrible mistake and I'm humiliated, I'm publicly shamed, or when I've done everything right and I do badly, or I've done everything wrong and I get punished for it, or I'm in a lawsuit with my partner, or you know, I'm wrongly accused of something, or I'm rightly accused of something because I did something really wrong. Who's going to be there for me? Who's going to be supporting me and giving me emotional strength? And so if you have a life that's so stunted and narrowly focused that all you're doing is picking stocks, or you don't have relationships with people who are going to be there for you, I think you're making yourself very vulnerable. And so I just think you have to think more deeply about these questions of how to be sustainably successful, both in investing and life. And that means you have to invest in your relationships. You have to invest in things like meditation, exercise, stuff like that. And so these things that I think in my youth I thought were just digressions, I think turn out to be really, really important.
So that was the first half of my conversation with William Green. Next time, we shall continue the discussion and learn what Charlie Munger said about William's book. We'll hear from the expert what it takes to be a good interviewer and why to be really good at investing, or indeed in any endeavor, William believes it helps to be just a bit weird. One thing stands out, Green is genuinely fascinated in people and in what makes a successful investor. And if you haven't read his book already, I thoroughly recommend it. Till next time, and part two of this conversation. By the way, we had a debate internally about splitting this episode into two or producing a longer interview. Splitting it is something of an experiment. I'd love to hear what my listeners think. Email me at info@behindthebalancesheet.com with your thoughts on this, or indeed on any aspect of the podcast. I love to get your feedback. Thanks as ever for your support.